Yeah, thank you very much for the introduction and for the, of course, for the invitation to give this seminar. As you probably guessed, this is going to be predominantly about scattering in the city space, which I'll define shortly. In particular, these works here on the bottom left, and also some work to up here. Okay, so one of the main reasons why we study particle scattering and in particular scattering amplitudes is that they allow us to test the predictions of our theories. So scattering amplitudes are like the critical bridge between theory and experiment. So let's suppose that you have your favorite theory that you believe describes nature. If you're a serious scientist, you compute some scattering amplitude, which gives you a prediction for what happens when particles in your theory scatter. And then once you've done that, you like scurry off to the Large Hadron Collider or whatever particle collider you have at your disposal to see how your prediction matches up against the measurements that they make. And if they don't, you have to put your theory in the bin in principle. But even in the case that we don't have the possibility to perform or to compare with experiments, scattering amplitudes provide us with like convenient theoretical laboratories for which we can put our theories to the test. A very elementary example of this is given to us by general relativity, where of course we don't have the possibility to perform experiments like directly at the Planck scale. But by considering graviton scattering amplitudes, we know that there's a problem in the applicability of GR at such scales. So already at one loop, you start to get a bit nervous because you find a divergence, but you still maintain some level of optimism because this divergence can be reabsorbed. And then when you go to two loops, you become sad because again you find a divergence, and this time there's nothing you can do about it, and that's the end of the story. So in this and similar ways, scattering amplitudes provide us with like some theoretical scaffolding for which we can test the limitations of our theories. And of course, we don't put general relativity in the bin because it describes our universe so beautifully well at large cosmological scales. And what we know by now is that we should regard both general relativity and the Standard Model through like the lens of effective field theory. So where the correct physical theory has this like onion-like structure with the different layers corresponding to the different energies with potentially different degrees of freedom becoming excited. So the problem that we face within this framework is to find consistent quantum theories that not only explain our existing experimental and observational data, so in their low energy limits include both the Standard Model and general relativity, but they should also give us some predictions for the experiments and observations that we haven't yet been able to make. And this is of course very hard in various respects or challenging. So scattering amplitudes are quite difficult to compute in general. So it would seem that we have already limited access to these theoretical laboratories. And even if the computation of scattering amplitudes wouldn't be an issue, the higher and higher energy that we would like to describe, we increasingly lack guidance from experimental data. So in the face of challenges, a change of perspective is never a bad idea. And one possibility is to perhaps be a little bit careful or even reverse the logic that I've presented so far. So instead of using scattering amplitudes in order to test the consistency of our theories, we could use consistency as an input in order to constrain or perhaps even determine the form that scattering amplitudes should take. So this type of approach is known as a bootstrap approach, which refers to the like the magical act of lifting oneself up by the straps of their own boots, so in a self-consistent and self-reinforcing manner. And if implemented successfully, this is what would provide us with the theoretical data points for which we can carve out the space of consistent theories. So the basic physical criteria that consistent scattering amplitudes should satisfy include, for instance, Lorentz invariance, unitarity, and locality. And these are actually included in a pretty simple way in scattering amplitudes. So Lorentz invariance requires that the amplitudes depend on Lorentz invariant combinations of the kinematic variables. Unitarity requires that S target S is equal to 1, so where S is the S matrix, and this gives rise to the optical theorem, and so on. And locality requires that the amplitudes have kinematic singularities that are consistent with factorization and unitarity. So for instance, simple poles in the Mandelstam variables along the real axis that correspond to the exchange of physical particles. So quite remarkably, one can bootstrap a tremendous amount of physics from these basic criteria, and these have given rise to powerful techniques to compute scattering amplitudes in perturbation theory, such as recursion relations to construct tree amplitudes from lower point trees, generalized unitarity methods to construct loop amplitudes from on-shell tree amplitudes. But in spite of this tremendous progress, we still lack a complete picture of the criteria that should be satisfied by consistent scattering amplitudes. One of the probably the most striking example that we can think of this is that at least beyond one loop, we don't really know what is the fingerprint of causality, or perhaps even phrased more succinctly, we don't know what is the question to which the scatter amplitude is the answer. And as frustrating as it might be, the state of the art is still that it could be that if some random person off the street came to you with a scattering amplitude that they computed in their like pet quantum theory, it could be that you wouldn't be able to tell them if they are right or wrong. But if we allow ourselves to move just a little bit away from reality, there's like a spectacular working example of a scenario in which we know very well the rules of the game. And this is if instead of flat space, we put our theories and we put our world, our theories in, we consider theories in anti-de-Sitter space, which is like putting our world inside of a tin can. And the beauty of this setup is that through the ADS-CFT correspondence, such theories are equivalent to a conformal field theory living on the boundary of this tin can. So what does this all mean? So in ADS, we can perform experiments that start and end at infinity by like pinging things off the walls of the tin can. And through the ADS-CFT correspondence, such observables are computed by correlation functions of operators in the conformal field theory. And this is the reason. And the, sorry, they did my flatmate is making a lot of noise. And the striking thing about this is that all of our questions and confusions about observables in asymptotic anti-de-Sitter space can be translated to sharp questions about the consistency of correlation functions in conformal field theory, which are defined completely non-perturbatively by a combination of conformal symmetry, unitarity, and a consistent operator product expansion. And these are the three main pillars behind the so-called conformal bootstrap program, which uses these three basic consistency criteria, among others, to carve out the space of consistent conformal field theories. So given this spectacular working example, a natural question to ask is if any of the techniques which led to this type of progress anti-de-Sitter space can be adapted to understand scenarios that are closer to that of our own universe. A pretty good starting point would be anti-de-Sitter's positive curvature cousin, so de-Sitter space. So this is a step away from the relative security of the ADS-CFT correspondence in a direction where we might potentially learn something fundamentally new about holography itself, so the emergence of time. So the point is that in de-Sitter space, the boundaries at infinity are space-like, one at past infinity and the other at future infinity with time running in between. And this is to be contrasted with the standard ADS-CFT setup, which we presented a few slides ago, where the boundary has a time direction, so a standard notion of locality and causality. But this, at the same time, this setup retains some familiar features that we might look to for reassurance or try to take advantage of. And one of these is that these boundaries at infinity are conformal. So the corresponding observables are constrained by conformal symmetry, like in ADS CFT. So in this talk, we're going to be interested in those processes in which all of the external legs lie on the boundary at future infinity. And these are of particular interest from the perspective of inflationary cosmology, which, as we know, postulates that the very early universe is a period of very rapid expansion. And this can be described by the de Sitter space-time. And one of the main predictions is that spatial correlations at the end of inflation, so say on this gray spatial slice here, so say the scalar or the tensor fluctuation, the prediction as time evolves forward, these give rise to correlations in the CMB or the distribution of galaxies. And this would make inflation the highest energy observable natural process. So in particular, the energy of the Hubble scale during inflation could be as high as 10 to the 14 GeV, which is far beyond what we can hope to achieve with our humble terrestrial experiments. So inflation therefore presents us with this incredible opportunity to try to like poke at the laws of physics at these scales, which so far have remained somewhat elusive. They haven't yet poked back. And the task that we have ahead is to classify the effects or the imprints of new degrees of freedom that might become excited at these scales, together with those degrees of freedom that we already know to exist. And this is to compare with future observations of these guys. What I've just outlined is what is known as the cosmological collider physics program. And this has been pioneered by numerous groups, an incomplete list of which you can find here at the top of the slide. And this is essentially where we view the inflationary expansion as this like insane high energy particle collider. So in order to reach the goals of this program, precisely in the spirit of the bootstrap that I outlined a few slides ago, we need to gain a better understanding of the structure of these correlators on the boundary at future infinity. And at the same time, develop systematic techniques in order to compute them, because this is what, at the end of the day, would allow us to classify the imprints of such new degrees, of potential new degrees of freedom. So in recent years, we've seen significant progress in this direction, with some key steps taken by this ever-growing and incomplete list of groups here at the bottom of the slide. Many of which indeed drew inspiration from the successes and the strengths of the scattering amplitudes program. So in this talk, I'm going to focus on explaining the contribution of these collection of works here, whose aim was to explore how techniques for studying scattering amplitudes or scattering processes in anti-de Sitter space could be adapted to those in de Sitter space. And this question is not entirely unreasonable, because at the end of the day, many of such techniques were developed in Euclidean ADS, because oftentimes it's simpler to work in Euclidean signature. And Euclidean ADS shares the isometry group with the de Sitter spacetime. So me personally, I would not fall over with shock if it does turn out that there are some things that do carry over. But we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves, because these spacetimes are of course rather different beasts. And one major difference is that the de Sitter background is time dependent. So in contrast to the perturbative computation of correlation functions on the boundary of Euclidean ADS, in de Sitter, these are computed within the so-called in-in or Schwinger-Keldysh formalism. So this is where you have to take an extra bit of care when evaluating the bulk time integral. So you first have to integrate from the initial time in a time-ordered fashion along the so-called plus branch of the in-in contour to the boundary at future infinity. And then once you've done that, you have to integrate back in an anti-time ordered fashion from the boundary to early times again along the so-called minus branch of the in-in contour. And you have to do this for each of the integrals that appear in your Feynman diagram computations. So these types of differences, they make at least a direct application of many such ADS techniques far from straightforward, at least in the current way that they are formulated. So one of the main objectives of the work that I'm going to tell you about was to see if there was some way in which we could level the playing field between boundary correlators in these two spacetimes. And to this end, we found it rather convenient to adopt a type of Mellin-Barnes representation for boundary correlators in momentum space, which I'll introduce very shortly in the first part of the talk. So Mellin-Barnes integrals, you might recognize as contour integrals, which involve products and ratios of gamma functions, where the integration contour is usually taken to run parallel to the imaginary axis. So on the slide here, you're seeing a well-known example of such a Mellin representation, so that of the Gauss hypergeometric function. And such a representation has been instrumental in establishing many properties of such hypergeometric functions, such as identities, transformation formula, and asymptotic expansions. And similar statements can be made about the such Mellin representation of the boundary correlators that I'll introduce. And what we found is that this representation for boundary correlators, both in ADS and de situ, it's a useful tool to explore their properties, and in particular to forge identities which hold between boundary correlators in these two spacetimes. And it's such identities which allow us to directly import techniques and results, and also understanding from ADS to de situ. So after introducing this Mellin-Barnes representation in the first part of the talk, in the second part, I'll explain how we put some of these ideas into practice. We'll start off with the contact diagrams, which are the basic building blocks from which we can construct more complicated observables. And we'll see how this Mellin formalism allows us to obtain, to immediately express a contact diagram in de situ in terms of its ADS counterpart. We'll then move on to exchanges. And for both ADS and de situ, we will see that given the knowledge of the constituent three-point contact diagrams, the Mellin formalism allows us to quite straightforwardly implement the basic consistency criteria of factorization, conformal symmetry, and boundary conditions to determine the corresponding tree-level exchange, so precisely in the spirit of the bootstrap. In the final part of the talk, if there's time, we'll explore how using our results in this Mellin-Barnes formalism, we can derive constraints on the interactions of master spinning particles in a similar spirit to Weinberg's analysis in flat space, extending it both to ADS and de situ. So before I move on to the main part of the talk, are there any questions at this point?
I myself have a small question, Charlotte. Yes. So you mentioned about contact diagrams and exchange diagrams in de situ. I think people also compute loop corrections in inflationary backgrounds and stuff. So do the loop corrections also carry over or?
Yes, exactly. So so in this talk, I will focus on just the tree level exchanges and also tree level contact diagrams, but the framework carries over. So what we can do is, it's very easy to see given the formalism that I present that it extends immediately to loops. So in particular, you can express diagram by diagram, a de situ loop diagram is a specific linear combination of ADS loop diagrams. So they address some factor which kind of like accommodate for changing consistency conditions as you move from ADS to de situ. So you will see that there are some factors which make sure that the diagram is consistent with unitarity, for instance.
I see.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah. I'm also very sorry because my house is a bit noisy right now, so I hope that the sound is not infiltrating into the...
No, it's perfectly fine. We can
hear you. Okay, good. Thank you. Thank you for reassuring me about this. Okay, so let me first introduce this Mellin-Barnes representation. And for good measure, to make sure we're all on the same page, let me first quickly review some bread and butter of the ADS-CFD dictionary. A major part of which was laid down by Gubser, Klebanov, Polyakov, and Witten. And this essentially boils down to the fact that the ADS-CFT correspondence identifies the generating function of correlators in the conformal field theory with the full partition function of the would-be quantum gravity theory in antithetical space, where in particular the boundary value phi bar of a field phi in ADS, it serves as a source for a corresponding operator O in the conformal field theory, so for a coupling on the boundary of this type here. So in particular, the spin J of such a local operator is equal to that of the elementary field in ADS that sources it. And if this field is subject to the Dirichlet boundary condition, the local operator has a scalene dimension delta plus, which is related to the mass of the elementary field through this identity here. So through these identifications, endpoint correlation functions of operators in the conformal field theory, they're identified with endpoint scattering processes of their dual fields in anti-de Sitter. So what we did is we defined or introduced a Mellin bounds representation of these boundary correlation functions, and in particular in momentum space, so taking the Fourier transform of these position vectors x here on the boundary. So I'm given such a boundary correlator describing some scattering process in a Bolt spacetime, for each of the external legs in this scattering process, which each will have some boundary momentum ki, we introduce this Mellin bounds representation by associating to each of these external legs a corresponding what we call external Mellin variable si, where the magnitude of the momentum enters this Mellin bounds representation in the way that you see here on the slide. So we have an exponent that is fixed by the corresponding external Mellin variable si, as well as the scalene dimension delta I of the corresponding operator on the boundary. And each of these external legs is accompanied by two infinite families of poles, which I plotted here on the bottom of the slide. And these turn out to be the poles in the Mellin bounds representation of the bulk boundary propagators associated to these external legs. So in particular, in Poincaré coordinates of anti-de Sitter space, these bulk boundary propagators are modified Bessel functions of the second kind in momentum space. And the Mellin bounds representation of such modified Bessel functions, as you can see here on the bottom left, in the case of a scalar field, they're precisely characterized by such two infinite families of poles here, which are encoded in these two gamma functions. And in particular, the location of these poles, they depend on the mass of the external particle, which enters through the scalene dimension delta I, using the identity that you saw on the previous slide. So an interesting thing to note is that, similar to how translation invariance on the boundary implies momentum conservation of the boundary momentum, and the dilatation order identities, they imply a similar constraint on the corresponding external Mellin variables. So they must sum up to a constant, and I will give some examples of this constant in a moment. And similar to how the momentum conserving delta function arises from an integral of a position x on the boundary, so x here parameterizes the boundary dimensions, the delta function enforcing this constraint on the external Mellin variables, it can be written in a similar way as an integral over the bulk radial coordinate, which in Poincaré coordinates we usually call z. So for me, it would be interesting to understand if there's something that is to be learnt from these parallels that we can draw between momentum space and this Mellin bounds representation, which make it, for me at least, a little bit tempting to wonder if this Mellin representation is some kind of convenient or natural habitat for conformal correlation functions in momentum space. But this is not something that we've explored beyond drawing these nice parallels here. So the simplest type of boundary correlators are those corresponding to three-point contact diagrams. These only have external legs, and there are three of them. So according to the definitions above, in the Mellin representation is described by three external Mellin variables, S1, S2, and S3, one for each external leg. Translation invariance on the boundary implies momentum conservation. And the dilatation ward identities require that the external variables S1, S2, and S3 sum up to this constant here, which depends on the boundary dimension D and the spin J of the fields that participate in this cubic vertex. If we also have an internal leg, like in a four-point exchange, in this Mullin representation, each internal leg is described by a pair of what we call internal Mullin variables, U and U bar. And the reason why there are two, you will see later on. And this, the magnitude of the momentum associated to this each internal leg enters the Mullin representation the way that you can see here on the slide. So, with an exponent that is fixed by the sum of these internal Mullin variables, U and U bar. So, similar to how momentum, the momentum associated to the internal leg Ki is related to the external momentum through momentum conservation at a cubic vertex, these Mullin variables U and U bar, they're related to the external Mullin variables S1, S2, and S3 through the constraint that we saw on the previous slide here for Mullin variables that are connected through a cubic vertex, so those which mediate the exchange that we are considering. So what we found is that by adopting such a Mullin bands representation for boundary correlators in these two spacetimes, we found that this places their computation on a more equal footing. And the thing which really lowered the drawbridge is that in this Mullin bands representation, propagators in ADS and De Sitter, they take a universal form, and they're constructed essentially out of three basic building blocks. So focusing on propagators in for now in anti-De Sitter space, so for of generic mass M and spin J, we have the red, the yellow, and the green building blocks. The green building block is the corresponding harmonic function, so it solves the source-free equation of motion. So this means it encodes the physical exchange single particle state. So in the Mullin bands representation of this harmonic function, the residues of the poles in the internal Mullin variables U and U bar, they generate the contributions from physical exchange single particle state, so analogous to simple poles in the Mandelstam variables. The yellow building block is what enforces the boundary condition, which is a linear combination of these functions, omega d and omega n, whose role is to respectively implement the Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions. So remember that the most general boundary behavior of a field in anti-De Sitter space is a linear combination of the two, which you can see here at the bottom of the slide in Poincaré coordinates. So these functions, their explicit form is rather simple. They're entire functions in the internal Mullin variables U and U bar, which means that they don't contribute any pole to this Mullin bands representation. And as you can see here on the slide, they're given by a simple product of sine functions. So they have a factorized dependence on U and U bar. And as you will see later on, essentially what happens is that the zeros of these sine functions, they overlap with the poles of the harmonic function that would violate the boundary condition that you want to implement out of Dirichlet and Neumann. So the final building block, the red one, is this cosecant factor. And as is written, its role is to encode the contact terms in the exchange process. So in particular, the combination of the yellow and the green building block, so far they just satisfy the source-free equation of motion with some boundary condition. And this cosecant factor ensures this propagator satisfies the equation of motion with a source as required for a book boundary, a book propagator. So for consistency, if you put the internal leg on shell, so if you take the cut or the discontinuity with respect to the internal momentum, and this cosecant factor gets completely cancelled, as you can see here. And what you get back is the combination of the yellow and the green building block. So this is the Mullin bands representation of propagators in anti-De Sitter space. In De Sitter, within this in-in formalism, to each field is associated four propagators, because these two points can each sit either on the plus or minus branch of the in-in contour. And each of these four propagators, they take the same form as their ADS counterpart. So they're built from analogous building blocks which have the same role as their counterparts in anti-de-Sitter space. So in particular, so this deserves clarification. So in de-Sitter, what we mean by implementing a boundary condition is choosing a vacuum at early times. And in de-Sitter, we have an entire one parameter family of vacua to choose from, the so-called alpha vacua. And in this talk, we'll be working in particular with the Bunch-Davis or Euclidean vacuum. And this is the vacuum that you get, as its name suggests, by analytically continuing to de-Sitter from the sphere. It's also the unique vacuum, it's the vacuum that uniquely extrapolates to that of flat Minkowski space. And this choice of vacuum, it corresponds to this particular choice here of the coefficients alpha and beta that multiply these projectors omega d and omega n. So the crucial bridge between propagators in these two spacetimes is that at the level of this Mellin-Barnes representation, a harmonic function in de-Sitter space is given by its counterpart in Euclidean ADS, multiplied by two very simple phases in U and U bar. Where you can see here, looking at the sign of these phases, the sign depends on the branch of the in-in contour that the two points of the harmonic function are sitting on. And you can actually establish this relation by wick rotating from de-Sitter, from anti-de-Sitter to de-Sitter space. So for instance, taking the harmonic function in Poincaré coordinates in Euclidean ADS and establishing its Mellin-Barnes representation. And then you wick rotate to like the expanding Poincaré patch in de-Sitter space, where the direction of rotation, so clockwise or anticlockwise, it tends to dictate whether you land on the plus or minus branch of the in-in contour. If you take the boundary limit, you get bulk boundary propagators. And since these bulk boundary propagators are associated to external legs, the Mellin representation is described by a single external Mellin variable, S. And in a similar way, so for a given boundary behavior, which I call delta, bulk boundary propagators in de-Sitter are given by their counterparts in Euclidean ADS multiplied by a simple phase of the same type, where again, the sign of this phase depends on the branch of the in-in contour that this point here in the bulk is sitting on. So these observations are significant because they tell us that the differences between boundary correlators in these two spacetimes, they amount to a simple collection of phases. So this really provides us with a framework in which we can try to extend in quite a concrete way, as we will see, existing techniques and results from ADS to de-Sitter. So let's explore how this works, starting off with the contact diagrams, which are the basic building blocks from which we can construct more complicated observables. And using this Mellin formalism, we can immediately express a contact diagram in de-Sitter in terms of its ADS counterpart. And at the three-point level, expressions for these are available for any triplet of particles, so of any mass, spin, and a cubic coupling that connects them. So to do this, the only thing that you have to do is take the Mellin-Barnes representation of the contact diagram in anti-de-Sitter space. And for each of the legs in this contact diagram, you multiply it by the phase which converts these legs to a bulk boundary propagator on a particular branch of the in-in contour in de-Sitter. So using the identity that you saw a few slides ago. So this is what gives you the contribution from a given branch to the de-Sitter contact diagram. So from this, we see that to get the contribution from the plus or minus branch of the in-in contour to a de-Sitter contact diagram, you take its ADS counterpart and you multiply by some phase. And the overall phase that you get when you apply this procedure is a constant because you see that the overall phase depends on the sum of the external Mellin variables, S1, S2, and S3, which we know is a constant from a few slides ago by virtue of the dilatation ward identities. So this is the contribution to the de-Sitter contact diagram from a given branch of the in-in contour. And the full de-Sitter contact diagram is simply given by summing the two, so the plus and minus branches. And so these constant phases, which have opposite sign, they combine to give this sign factor multiplying the ADS contact diagram. So to summarize this part, if you have a three-point contact diagram in anti-de Sitter space, you can obtain its de Sitter counterpart by simply multiplying by this sign factor here. And let me also mention that this carries over in exactly the same way to contact diagrams involving any number n of external legs. So taking exactly the same steps. And I just flashed the result here for completeness. So an interesting consequence of the appearance of this sign factor is that it can happen that a contact diagram in de Sitter is vanishing, even if its ADS counterpart is not. And this occurs when the boundary dimension D, the number of external legs N, the scalar dimensions delta, and the spins J conspire to give a zero this function. So of course this can happen in various weird and wonderful ways, with some interesting examples of course given by boundary dimensions D equals to three because we're in four space-time dimensions. So for instance, if we consider contact diagrams involving only conformally coupled scalars, which corresponds in D equal three to scalar dimension delta equal to one, and of course spins J equal to zero, plugging in these numbers into our formula, you get this sign factor here. So from this, you can see that this sign factor has a zero when the number n of external legs is odd. So from this, you can conclude that contact diagrams involving only conformally coupled scalars with an odd number of legs is vanishing. So this and other similar examples were confirmed also by this work here by the Cambridge group. And quite nicely, they showed it to unitarity, so by deriving a cosmological analog of the optical theorem. And from their result, we could understand that this sign factor here is in some ways selected by unitarity in de Sitter space. And in this Mellin formalism, we can understand it because this sign factor, it originates from the phases, so here, which take us from ADS to de Sitter. And these phases are precisely fixed by the propagators in de Sitter space, which are what it precisely encode unitary time evolution in the bulk. So before I move on to exchanges, are there any questions at this point? Okay, so in some way we know that three-point contact diagrams are the basic building blocks from which we can construct the exchanges. So to explore how this works within the Mellin formalism, let's first understand how it works in anti-de Sitter space, which have been well studied using a variety of techniques. So we have some prior intuition. So in the introductory slides, we saw that in this Mellin formalism, a propagator can be reconstructed from its on-shell piece by multiplying with this cosecant factor that encodes the contact terms. And this has some nice consequences when it comes to constructing boundary correlators in this framework, because it means that we can focus on the on-shell piece, which is a much simpler object to deal with and to construct. So you focus on the on-shell piece and you obtain the full boundary correlator at the end by just multiplying with this cosecant factor that encodes the contact terms. So this means that in the following, we can just focus on the exchange and done. And this is constrained by a combination of factorization. So on-shell, the exchange must factorize into its three-point subamplitudes by locality. So just like in flat space. And the anti-de-Sitter space, and also in de Sitter, it's constrained by conformal symmetry and whatever boundary condition that you would like to implement on your exchanged particle. So we've seen that boundary conditions in this Mellin formalism, they're quite straightforward to implement. It just amounts to multiplying by the appropriate linear combination of projectors in the internal Mellin variables U and U bar. So since the boundary conditions can be corrected for at the end, let's focus on the constraints coming from factorization and conformal symmetry. So to try to satisfy factorization, thing that you try to do is you can make the three-point contact diagrams generated by the cubic couplings that mediate your exchange for all possible combinations of boundary conditions on the internal leg, and just multiply them together. And if you do that, there's a unique object that is consistent with conformal symmetry at the four-point level, which is this guy here that you're looking at on the slide, where one of the internal legs is subject to the delta plus boundary condition and the other to the delta minus boundary condition. So in the conformal field theory literature, such an object is known as a conformal partial wave. It has some useful properties. And in particular, it's a single-valued eigenfunction of the conformal Casimirs. So this object is consistent with factorization and conformal symmetry. It describes the on-shell exchange of a particle in anti-Visitor with a boundary condition definition of the conformal partial wave itself. It's some linear combination of Dirichlet and Neumann boundary conditions. So to access more general boundary conditions, the key thing to note is that the conformal partial wave up here, it's the boundary dual object to the harmonic function in the book that we saw earlier, which we used to construct our propagators in this Mellin formalism. So in particular, the source-free equation of motion satisfied by this harmonic function is equivalent to the conformal, the quadratic conformal Casimir equation. And this duality is made manifest by the so-called split representation of harmonic functions, which is where it factorizes into a product of two book boundary propagators, one subject to the delta plus boundary condition and the other to the delta minus boundary condition. So you can go essentially from one to the other, so from the harmonic function to the conformal partial wave by just attaching and removing the So in this duality, we can implement a given boundary condition by just multiplying the conformal partial wave by the appropriate linear combination of projectors omega d and omega n that implement that boundary condition at the level of the corresponding on-shell propagator. I see some things in the chat. Are there questions?
No, Charlotte. Once in a while, your audio gets cut off or a bit muddled up, but otherwise it's fine.
I see. Do I need, should I repeat anything? Was it for a long time? Or?
Not really, but I think if you're closer to your microphone, then I think it's better. But once you go far or something, I guess.
I will try to, because I have to use mobile internet. Sorry, my house is very chaotic at the moment. Sorry about this. Okay, so let's, Okay, so what we did, so this is the final form. So to implement a given boundary condition, as I said, we multiply the conformal partial wave by the appropriate linear combination of projectors, omega d and omega n, that implement that boundary condition at the level of the corresponding propagator. So in this way, we fix the final form of the on-shell exchange by a combination of factorization, conformal symmetry, and boundary conditions. And we've seen that this is quite straightforward to implement in this Mellin formalism. It just amounted to clicking together these basic building blocks in a consistent fashion. So in particular, we didn't note that we didn't have to evaluate any complicated bulk integral in establishing this expression, because we essentially bootstrapped it from the knowledge of the constituent three-point conduct diagrams, which, as I said, we note that they are available for any particle and a cubic coupling that connects them. So this is the on-shell exchange. And the final step is simply to multiply by this cosecant factor that encodes the contact terms in the exchange process. So in particular, the poles that are introduced in U and U bar from this cosecant factor, what they do is they generate the effective field theory part of the exchange from this on-shell piece here. So using this Mellin bands, representation, we can carry over the steps that we've just taken to obtain the exchange in anti-Visitor space directly to De Sitter. And in De Sitter, the exchange decomposes into contributions within the in-in formalism. And these are four in total, since the two points in the exchange can each sit either on the plus or minus branch of the in-in contour. And just like this, each of these contributions on shell in the in-in formalism, they're constrained by a combination of factorization, conformal symmetry, and boundary conditions. So at the level of each of these contributions, we just continue like we did in anti-data space. So in particular, to satisfy factorization, again, we take the constituent three-point contact diagrams, this time from the appropriate branches of the in-in contour. And again, we multiply them together. And again, the unique object that is consistent with conformal symmetry at the four-point level is a conformal partial wave. This is in fact proportional to the conformal partial wave that we saw earlier, because we know that contact diagrams in ADS and the sitter, they are proportional to each other. So these guys in particular, they differ by a constant phase. Another way to phrase it is that this conformal partial wave here is normalized so that it's consistent with factorization in the sitter as opposed to factorization at this level, we can effortlessly pass from one to the other. So for instance, starting from the conformal partial wave in anti-data space and multiplying each leg by the phase that implements the wick rotation to the appropriate branch of the in contour in the sitter. So at this point, we can just continue like we did in anti-data sitter space. So to ensure that we're in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, each of the conformal partial waves from each in contour contribution, we multiply by the appropriate linear combination of the projectors omega d and omega n that implement that boundary condition, so which corresponds to these particular values here of the coefficients alpha and beta. And then to obtain the full on-shell exchange, we simply have to sum the contributions, all four of them, from the in-in contours. So in this, just like in anti-data space, we fix the on-shell exchange in the sitter by a combination of factorization, conformal symmetry, and boundary conditions. And to obtain the full exchange as before, we simply have to multiply by this cosecant factor that encodes the contact terms. So given this, having placed correlators in ADS and the sitter on a similar footing with the aid of this Mellin-Barnes formalism, it doesn't take much to see that an exchange in the sitter, at least in the Bunch-Davis vacuum, can be written as a specific linear combination of ADS exchanges. One exchange where in ADS where the exchange field is subject to the Dirichlet boundary condition or the delta plus boundary condition, and the other, the delta minus boundary condition. So to see this, we see the same representation that we established for the de-Sitter exchange in the Bunch-Davis vacuum. And we recall that the three-point contact diagrams in the sitter, they're given by their ADS counterparts multiplied by a constant phase, where the sign of this phase depends on the branch of the in-in contour. So this is this identity here is the crucial bridge to exchanges in anti-data sitter space. And when we sum up this contribution, all of the contributions from the in-in contours, these constant phases, they combine to give this product of sign factors here that multiply the exchanges in anti-data sitter space, where the exchange subject to the Dirichlet boundary condition is read off from the part of the de Sitter exchange involving this projector omega d. And the exchange with Neumann boundary condition is read off from the part of the de Sitter exchange involving the projector. So notice that these sign factors that multiply both ADS exchanges, these are precisely the sign factors that would convert the constituent three-point contact diagrams in ADS to their de Sitter counterparts. So the appearance of these sign factors, they're precisely what accommodate for the change in three-point function coefficient or the operator product expansion coefficient as we move from ADS space to de Sitter space. And just like at the three-point level, you can show using this work of the Cambridge group on the cosmological optical theorem, you can show that this precise combination of sign factors, they in some way, they're essentially selected by unitarity. So why do I find this interesting? So what we have here is an identity between exchanges in an exchange in the Bunch-Davies vacuum and in de Sitter, and an exchange in anti-de Sitter space. And this holds regardless of the way that we choose to represent the two. So it holds if these exchanges are expressed in position space or momentum space, for instance. And so we can use this identity to directly import techniques and results from for exchanges from ADS to de Sitter. And this for me is particularly exciting given the increasingly central role that is being played by exchanges in anti-de Sitter space and the bootstrap of conformal field theories. So exchanges in ADS, these are the basic building blocks which solve the crossing equation. So this all-important equation which enforces the associativity of the operator algebra, the operator product expansion. And the hope is that through this identity, one might be able to start exploring the bootstrap of Euclidean CFTs dual to physics. So in our recent work, we took some small steps in this direction. So in particular, using this identity, we can infer properties of de Sitter exchanges, which are inherited from those of their ADS counterparts. One particularly important property that we know in ADS is that these are the exchanges in anti-de Sitter space are single-valued functions of the cross ratios. So this is the crucial property which ensures that the exchanges in ADS, they admit a well-defined decomposition into conformal blocks in all channels, which ensures that they solve the crossing equation. So from this identity, we can then conclude that exchanges in de Sitter, they also are single-valued functions of the cross ratios. They also solve the crossing equation, and they also admit a well-defined decomposition into conformal blocks in any channel. And their decomposition of ADS exchanges into conformal blocks in any channel. So apart from properties, we can also import technology. And using our in our recent paper, we use this identity to define Millin amplitudes for correlation functions in de Sitter. So in anti-de Sitter space, such Millin amplitudes have proven to be an instrumental tool, also in the bootstrap of conformal field theories, owing to their striking parallels that they have with scattering amplitudes in flat space. So coming back to the Millin bands representation, let's explore a little bit how it packages the physics. So the signal indicating that a particle exchange is taking place, so the signal that would distinguish it from a local contact interaction, this is particularly sharp in the limit where the exchange momentum Ki is soft, so where its magnitude is less than that of all of the other momenta. And in conformal field theory, this corresponds to, this is what is called the operator product expansion limit, which in position space corresponds to taking the two pairs of points to be far apart. So the behavior of the correlator in this limit is a good diagnostic of whether or not a particle has been exchanged between these two pairs of points. So this limit of exchanges, both in ADS and de Sitter, has been explored in numerous works. Our analysis is most similar in spirit to that of the Kanyemed and collaborators, in particular the Amsterdam group, who in a similar way used conformal symmetry and basic consistency like factorization to classify such signatures in the case of free boundary dimensions and external conformally coupled and mass. So it turns out that this Millin formalism is quite a useful tool to explore soft limits in any of the momenta, where the expansion of correlators in these limits is generated by the residues of poles in the corresponding Millin variables. So for instance, in the soft limit of this internal momentum Ki, this is generated by the residues of poles in the corresponding internal Millin variables U and U bar. And you can understand this by recalling how the magnitude of this internal momentum Ki enters the Millin representation. So we have an exponent that is fixed by the sum of these internal Millin variables U and U bar. So for the on-shell exchange, which is the important piece which encodes the physical exchange single particle states, it better give us some signal that a particle exchange has taken place. And you come from the constituent three-point contact diagrams. So I record these on the bottom left. These are precisely the poles of the modified Bessel function of the second kind, which come from the propagators associated to those of the internal legs in blue here. So these are two infinite families that are integer-spaced and head off to minus infinity. And in particular, their location depends on the mass of the exchange particle, which enters through the scalar dimension delta in the usual way. So this is somewhat similar in spirit to exchange amplitudes in flat space, where the contribution from the physical exchange single particle state is generated from the residue of a pole in the kinematic variable whose location depends on the mass of the exchanged particle. So when the exchange momentum Ki is soft, the integration contour here can be closed to the left. So it encloses both infinite families of poles U and U. So the rest of these poles generate the expansion of the exchange in this soft limit. And on the slide here, I give the schematic form of this expansion, focusing first on the case that all the fields participating in the exchange are scalars. And it turns out that each family of poles in U and U bar is responsible for a family of non-analytic terms in the exchange momentum. So in particular, if you recall the magnitude of this momentum Ki enters a Mellin representation, it's not difficult to see that the residues of poles here below the real axis, they're responsible for generating this family of non-analytic terms here on the first line, where the pole furthest to the right generates the leading contribution. Well, this family of poles here above the real axis, these are responsible for generating the family of poles here, the family of non-analytic terms here on the second. Non-analytic terms, they're the characteristic signal that a particle exchange has taken place. So they can't be emulated by a local quartic contact interaction, where the exponent of the exchange momentum is fixed by the late time behaviors, delta plus and delta minus of the exchanged field. And the fact that you get contributions from both the delta plus and delta minus modes, it's a consequence of our choice of Bunch-Davis vacuum. So on a practical level, this is because the coefficients of the projectors omega d and omega n in the Bunch-Davis vacuum are both non-zero. So if instead only the coefficient of omega d is non-zero, then this family of non-analytic terms on the second line would be absent, because the poles that generate them have been cancelled by the zeros of the projector omega d, which is this product of sine functions. So the zeros of these sine functions, they overlap with the poles in the three-point functions, which generate this family of non-analytic terms here on the second line. So this scenario is perhaps more physically meaningful in anti-de Sitter space, where it corresponds to implementing the Dirichlet boundary condition. And similarly, if only the coefficient of omega n is non-zero, then this family of non-analytic terms here on the first line is absent, because the poles that generate them have been cancelled by the zeros of the projector omega n, given in these sine functions. So if instead the exchange particle has integer spin j, there's also an angular dependence, so a dependence on this angle theta here. And in general, boundary dimensions, D, this is given by a Gegenbauer polynomial whose degree is equal to the spin J, the exchange particle. So in formalism, you can see this angular dependence matching because the constituent three-point conduct diagrams, they have a tensorial structure. And this tensorial structure has been contracted together to form a scalar. And it's this contraction which generates the dependence on this angle theta here. And if you also have external particles with spin, there's a tensorial structure in addition to this Gegenbauer polynomial. And this tensorial structure from this Mellin formalism, you can see, is inherited from the tensorial structure of the constituent three-point contact diagrams.
Sorry, Charlotte, I didn't get what this angle theta is, like which two vectors is this angle theta between?
So these lines here are those of the external momenta, so K1 to K4. And so it's, yeah, I should have drawn them on this. But yeah, it's this angle here, and I think this should be K1 and K2.
I see. Okay.
My hour is almost up, so I can wrap up very quickly in 5 minutes, I think. So far we only consider the contribution from the on-shell exchange. In the full exchange, another source of pulls in U and U bar, they come from this Kosygin factor here, and these are the red dots. So the residues of these pulls, these only generate terms that are analytic in the exchange momentum, because these are what encode the contact terms in the exchange process. So in particular, the residue of the nth pole, which lies to the left of this integration contour, is proportional to the nth power of the exchange momentum squared, where the coefficient of this term is given by the remaining Mellin integrals that are left after you evaluate this residue. And you can show that this it's an expansion in the inverse mass of the exchange particle, which is consistent with the fact that these terms should encode the effective field theory part of the exchange. So I also have a section on how we can derive constraints on massless particles within this formalism, but I'm also aware that I've eaten up the 1 hour of time. So I can also conclude here if you like. I think I can take 5 minutes to cover them.
Yeah, if you need a couple more minutes, I think that's fine. I mean, you started a bit late too.
Okay. So let me emphasize that this expression for the exchange is valid for generic collection of internal and external particles. So in particular, in deriving this expression, we took in dimensions to be generic, though of course ultimately one is interested in unitary representations of the de Sitter isometry group. And this expression is also valid for special representations like massless and partially massless fields, in the sense that in this case you have to plug in the corresponding gauge invariant three-point functions into this expression for the exchange. And in fact, gauge invariance manifests itself in quite an interesting way in this Mellin formalism. And a simple example to consider is cubic coupling of a massless spin J field to scalars. So if we consider the three-point contact diagram generated by such cubic coupling, gauge invariance requires that the lower helicity components, so from helicity J minus one to zero, it requires that they don't contain bulk contact terms. And the reason why is that massless spin J fields shouldn't propagate the lower helicity components. They're at most boundary terms. So how does this constraint manifest itself in Mellin formalism? So recall that in Mellin formalism, contact diagrams contain Dirac delta functions in the Mellin variables, which enforce the constraint coming from the dilatation ordered entities. And in the helicity decomposition, so for the helicity M component, this Dirac delta function is present, but with some argument that is shifted by the number of longitudinal indices J minus M. So in order for the lower helicity components to be boundary terms, as required by gauge invariance, each of these Dirac delta functions must be accompanied by a factor here, which is equal to its arguments in the way you see here on the slide. And the reason why is that this precise combination of factors is what represents a local boundary system arising from the integral over the bulk radial coordinate eta. So in the way that you see here. So this factor here, multiplying the Dirac delta function, is what cancels the bulk contact singularity that this Dirac delta function includes. So since three-point correlators involving two scalar operators and the spinning operator is unique, in order for it also to be consistent with gauge invariance, when you take the limit that the spin J field becomes massless, these boundary terms must arise in the lower helicity components. And this enforces a constraint on the mass of the scalars that can appear in the cubic coupling, because these boundary terms, they only emerge when the scalars have equal mass. And this is consistent with known results on consistent cubic couplings of mass of spinning fields to scalars. They can only exist if the scalars have the same. If you continue in this equal mass case, the corresponding boundary terms in the lower listed components, they are finite and non-zero, and this gives us a non-trivial Ward-Takahashi identity. So these are generated by a finite number of poles in the Mellin representation. So these poles here, and they are the poles which satisfy this constraint here, which is the constraint which sets to zero and the exponent of e to naught in the boundary term, which gives a finite contribution as you take the limit e to naught goes to zero. So for instance, if you look at the Hilsty J minus one component, you get this Ward-Takahashi identity here, which relates it to the two-point function of the scalar field. So O delta here is the operator dual to the scalar field. Xi is some auxiliary vector which conveniently packages the tensorial structure. So Hilsty gauge is cubic order in this manifoldness, and we can move on to quartics. So using our expression for the exchange in terms of these constituent gauge invariant three-point functions. And gauge invariance actually manifests itself in quite, gauge invariance at cubic order, which we've just enforced now, it doesn't imply gauge invariance at quartic order. And this is what gives us a constraint on the couplings, on the coupling G of the massless spin J field to the scalars. So a simple example to consider is a scalar exchange generated by our cubic vertex with a single external massless spin J field. And as usual, you have to sum over the contributions from the ST and U channels. And just like the three-point level, gauge invariance at 4 points requires that the lower Hilsty components don't contain bulk quartic contact terms. In a more technical language, it requires that there's no singularity in the total energy variable ET here, as ET goes to zero. So if we take our expression for the exchange, plug in the gauge invariant three-point function, and look at, say, the Hilsty J minus one component, which shouldn't contain any bulk quartic contact term. If we take these couplings G to be generic, what do we get? So first of all, you get what would be a contribution to a non-trivial Ward-Takahashi identity, which relates it to the three-point function of the scalar fields. This is actually generated from the on-shell part of the exchange, because we know that the on-shell exchange factorizes into constituent three-point contact diagrams, one of which is the gauge invariant three-point function that we just considered. But in addition to this, you get terms that would violate this Ward-Takahashi identity, so which contain bulk quartic contact singularities, so singularities in the total energy variable ET. So to try to restore gauge invariance, one thing that you can do is you can ask if there exists a local quartic vertex involving a single massless spin J field and three scalars whose contact diagram would cancel these bulk contact singularities. So singularities in the total energy variable ET. And the answer is negative. So we worked it out in the Mellin formalism, which is a bit technical. But essentially it amounts to classifying all possible singularities in this total energy variable that can be generated by local quartic contact diagrams. And what you find is that there are still bulk quartic contact singularities generated by exchanges, which can't be generated by local quartic. So to restore gauge invariance, the only thing that you can, terms that violate gauge invariance must cancel among themselves. And this is what gives you a constraint on these couplings G here. So in particular, from the lower Hilsty component, we get this constraint here of this type, which is precisely the same as the constraint that comes out of Weinberg's analysis in flat space. And hash here is some singularity that can't be generated by a local quartic vertex. And so for instance, in this way, you get for spin one and spin two, you recover charge conservation and the equivalence principle, which was also recovered in this work here by the Amsterdam group last year. And the new thing is that we find it, at least in local theories, so with local quartic contact diagrams, there's no consistent coupling of massless and higher spin massless fields to scalars, both in ADS and also and de Sitter. Okay, so to wrap up, plenty of directions to explore in the future, all as part of a program to study boundary correlators in the Smellenbands framework. Obvious next steps will be to study higher point and loop amplitudes, where one would proceed in a similar fashion to as I outlined in this talk. So focusing on the on-shell piece, which is a much simpler object to construct just by gluing together these basic building blocks. And where a nice parallel emerges with like the Kutkowski rules and generalized unitarity methods in flat space, as you can see here from this Kandy diagram. And in a similar way as we saw for the tree amplitudes, you can express a loop diagram in the sitter is a specific linear combination of ADS loop diagrams. And I would also be interested to understand if any of our results could be of interest or could be of use in the bootstrap of Euclidean CFTs due to physics in the sitter. And in particular, if the sitter exchanges could play an analogous prominent role to their ADS counterparts, in particular at the number level. So a final point that I'll mention is a bit more speculative, which is if our results could be, or formalism could be of any use in the context of flat holography, and in particular to construct celestial amplitudes, where it would be tempting to suggest that conformal symmetry on the celestial sphere would constrain the corresponding exchange to take a similar form, where of course you would replace the three-point contact diagrams here with those on the celestial sphere. So thank you for your attention, and thank you.
Thanks, Charlotte, for the very nice talk. I open the floor for questions now. Please unmute yourself if you want to ask a question. I mean, I can start. Like, so one simple question I want to ask to you, Charlotte, is that you showed us how to carry over these ADS computations to exact de Sitter spacetime by multiplying with appropriate phases and etc. How far can this be carried over to the actual physical world, where we know that the de Sitter symmetries were broken during inflation? I mean, it was not exactly.
Yeah, sure, of course. No, the only thing that we can do in this case is to, you know, consider like external massless scalars and set them to the background, and you know, break de Sitter symmetry in this way. That's the only thing that we can do. We can't. Because these results are constructed using exact conformal symmetry, and right. Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah, there's no. At least I haven't explored whether it can be
broken arbitrarily, right? Like, I mean, I guess the way you are like putting external legs on the background would give you the leading order. I see.
Yeah, as far as I know, that's the only thing we can do. Possibly. You'd have to check whether in the case where you have reduced symmetry, whether you can still develop formalism similar to this harmonic functions and so on. This is what we rely on. I haven't explored.
Are there other questions? Well, it doesn't look like there are other questions, Charlotte. So let me thank you again for this very nice talk and for agreeing to, like, it's like 7 p.m. in UK right now.
Yeah. Thank you very much for inviting me.